So, look, the international working class movement has been, for more than 100 years, being divided between two strategies to win socialism, the reformist and the revolutionary. Those advocating reform argue that workers' parties must win a parliamentary majority, pass legislation to improve the lot of the working class, and bit by bit, wrest power from the capitalists. This was a project of social democracy in the early 20th century when it emerged as a mass force in European politics. Revolutionaries, such as Russia's Bolsheviks, argued that workers' parties must instead overthrow the capitalist state and institute socialism from below, with insurgent workers establishing their own institutions to rule society. Social democracy has shifted far to the right since these early debates. Very few social democrats today even say their objective is socialism, merely a few reforms to improve the lot of workers. Just look at Keir Starmer in Britain, or for that matter, Anthony Albanese in Australia. These are actually from the left faction of their respective parties. Nonetheless, there are still faint echoes of earlier reformist strategies. People like Jeremy Corbyn, who argue that basic structures of capitalist rule can be reformed or at least make it work better for the working class. And it's very likely that when the class struggle begins to heat up again, left reformist currents will emerge once again. This means that the debate between reform and revolution is far from historic, but still current. So let's look at the reformist road in a bit more detail. Reformists venerate the state. They regard it as a neutral body that can be captured by the progressive left. And they see Parliament as a pinnacle of the state. This is going to show the classic story, the separation of powers, you know, the reformable nature of the system. But both of these conceptions are profoundly wrong. The state is not neutral, and several of the state elements are actively involved in a conspiracy to frustrate democracy. Marxists argue that the state is a coercive institution whose purpose is to enforce the rule of one class after another. It monopolizes the means of organized violence in its hands, the police, the army, the courts, and the jails to secure the domination of the ruling class. Parliamentary democracy, while still allowing the working class more rights than under fascism or dictatorship, is a screen serving to disguise this basic function. Why and how then does a state pursue the interests of the capitalists? One obvious means is by bribery and lobbying. Scarcely a day goes by that we don't hear of some senior company executive donating to the Labour Party or the coalition, or passing backhanders to senior public servants to secure preferential deals. But in the scheme of things, this is relatively unimportant. Even the cleanest government under capitalism would still serve the interests of the capitalist class. The chief reason that state serves the interests of the capitalists is because it depends on capital. Capitalist states depend on the ongoing flow of profits to secure their own institutions, to fund the armed forces and the police, to grab territory or resources from other capitalist states. This is why politicians elected to government very quickly absorb the need to protect the economy as one of their fundamental responsibilities. And by protecting the economy, they mean protecting profits. And then there are all the arms of the state that loyally serve the capitalist class. The armed forces, far from defending the nation, defend the interests of those with money. We doubt that. Look at the early role of the armed forces in Australia, dispossessing the Aboriginal population for the interests of the wealthiest squatters. The police's main role is to protect the property of the rich. If you doubt that, look at how the police behave on every picket line or mass demonstration. And the courts always serve the interests of the capitalists. Workers who steal a few dollars from the boss can be thrown in prison. Bosses who systematically steal from the workers, as they do every day, are at best given a slap on the wrist. Even departments of the state that seem a long way from repression work in favor of capital. Welfare, immigration, education, and health departments are all geared to ensuring that capitalists are provided with a suitable supply of healthy and literate labor. Welfare bureaucracies, which are meant to look after those in need, just as commonly harass the poor, which is also a good way of disciplining those in work. If you don't obey the boss, this will be your lot too. And it's not just that state serves the interests of the capitalists. State departments themselves operate just like capitalist enterprises, with a small minority of super well-paid bosses and a big majority of low-paid workers. Now, this doesn't mean that the state is merely a puppet of the capitalists. It does enjoy some autonomy. At times, the state acts to balance the interests of competing capitalists against each other, the better to do what is best for Australian capitalism as a whole. And occasionally, if the working class is demanding reforms through riots and demonstrations, the state can promote change in order to defuse this conflict. But if the state is not a puppet, it nonetheless works intimately with and within the capitalist class and in its interests. Okay, by now, I hope you can see that the state serves the interests of the tiny minority of capitalists. But can it perhaps be reformed despite all that? I would argue only in an extremely limited way. The state is not something that can just be moulded by parliamentary legislation to suit working class interests. For a start, the most important elements of the capitalist state are unelected: the judges, the public service bureaucrats, the army generals, and the police commissioners. Any government that tried to sack these figures and replace them with more progressive left-wing army commanders and police commissioners would immediately face ferocious opposition. The High Court could be relied upon to block the overhaul of state apparatus. Its job, after all, is to defend the Constitution, which is ultimately the Constitution of the property owners. And any attempt to purge generals or police commanders will lead to a revolt in their ranks and refusal to cooperate. Parliamentary elections also are not a good battleground for the working class. It's true that every worker has a vote, just the same as Twiggy Forrest and Gina Rinehart, but the way parliamentary elections are organised only muffles working class demands. Workers turn up to polling booths and millions of scattered individuals. They're subjected to intense media and corporate campaigning, urging them to support conservative candidates and turn their backs on radicals. And so while parliament is meant to represent the voice of the people, in practice, it only provides democratic legitimation to the rule of one class only, the capitalists. And even when sincere reformists do manage to get elected, they face insistent right-wing media pressure day after day, while by contrast, workers only get a chance to vote once every 3 or 4 years. Just look, for example, at a press onslaught against Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. Besides which, the spoils of office are very enticing: the salary, the allowances, and so forth. The result is that the vast majority of radical politicians who have gone into parliament have capitulated and become loyal defenders of the status quo. It is they who are reformed and not the state. The rare minority who have not given in to these pressures have either been expelled or relegated to the margins of the party. Again, look at Corbyn's fate. These are all important obstacles to any reforming government. But even if it did manage to pass a series of important reforms, this would still not constitute socialism. Running the capitalist state in such a way as to redistribute resources to workers is not socialism, the rule of the working class. At best, we'd have a more generous welfare state, more public ownership, but it would still be a capitalist economy and a capitalist state. Workers would still be exploited and alienated from any control over the running of their workplaces and society. No parliament is back to pass legislation giving workers the right to dump their boss and elect a replacement. If the state machinery is unsuited to radical reform, an equally important obstacle is the power of the capitalist class outside the state. The likes of Jamie Packer and Frank Lowy are not going to sit back and allow their property to be taken from them. The capitalists can cause economic turmoil by pulling their money from the country, cancelling investment projects, shutting down their businesses, sacking thousands of workers, and hoarding supplies. In 2010, such threats by the mining bosses destroyed the Rudd government's proposed resources super profits tax and forced Rudd's resignation. The first thing his replacement, Julia Gillard, did was to scrap the tax. The capitalists can also work with conservative parties to block supply of funds to governments in the upper house if they have a majority there, and with the security forces to cause trouble for a reformist government. They can mobilize support for the American government, the IMF, and international capital. They can unleash big crowds of middle-class supporters in street demonstrations to intimidate the government. So we can see from this picture here of the Whitlam government being attacked by middle-class supporters, middle-class liberals in 1975. And their ultimate recourse is to team up with right-wing forces to launch a military coup or a fascist takeover. Two Labour governments have, in fact, been driven out of office by such measures. The first is the New South Wales government led by Jack Lang, who was sacked by the state governor at the height of the Great Depression in 1932 after threatening to delay payment of interest to British loans. The second was the Whitlam government, which was sacked in 1975 by the Governor-General, The dismissal was a final step in a year-long campaign of capitalist sabotage. The conclusion drawn by the Labour Party from Whitlam's sacking was that future Labour governments would have to become even more conservative, even more prepared to do what business demanded. And this is so obvious today with the Albanese governments. Immediately, in fact, on being elected, they dropped their pre-election pledge to defend workers' wages. Are in fact now saying that workers will have to accept 1 or 2 years at least of falling wages. At the very same time, they're continuing through the Morrison government's tax cuts for the rich. Disgusted by Labour's right-wing policies in office, some have looked to the Greens as an alternative party of reform. The Greens have at times posed to the left of the ALP, but their project is just the same. Minor reforms within the system while leaving the class structure intact. You can see this with their behaviour since this year's election. Just in recent weeks, they voted up the Albanese government's rotten climate change bill and have done nothing to mobilise people to fight wage cuts, nor for that matter, to push for serious measures to halt the ongoing death toll from the pandemic. Neither the Greens nor the Labour Party, in fact, is the answer to anyone looking to challenge the horrors of capitalism. So what then is the revolutionary alternative? I would argue that we need a revolution for two simple reasons. First, because the ruling class is not going to just peacefully give up power. We must disarm our rulers and build a new world with our own hands. And that cannot be done through parliament. Secondly, because only by going through the experience of revolution does a working class become fit to rule. Like the terms democracy and freedom, the meaning of revolution is not always clear. For Marxists, we mean not a palace coup with changes of two figureheads, but a total reorganization of society. Revolution is the ultimate social leap, a period when the gradual accumulation of mass bitterness and anger of the oppressed bursts forth into a mass movement to overturn existing social relations and replace them with a new society. In today's world, that means a workers' revolution to smash the capitalist state and begin the process of building socialism. As Trotsky put it, revolution is the forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. This is the very opposite of reformism, which reduces the working class to bit players. Revolutions are, in fact, dramatic events. A few days of revolutionary upheaval bring more change than decades of normal development. Rulers and systems that seemed invincible can be overthrown almost overnight. You only need to think of the Arab revolutions in 2011, the Sudanese revolution of 2019, or even the mass struggles in Sri Lanka in recent months to see how long-established presidents have been overthrown by mass movements. And these were not even working-class revolutions. When workers seize power, like they did in Russia in 1917, the whole of society is turned upside down. Now, that all sounds very dramatic. It all seems like a long way away from where we are today, particularly in a wealthy country like Australia. And it's true that most workers regard revolution as far-fetched at most of the time. It's not just that ruling class goes out of its way to ridicule the notion of revolution. It's also that the ideas that encourage passivity we see around us and which makes revolution seem like such a remote prospect fit with our experiences of capitalism. It's true, our lives are generated by forces that seem seemingly outside our control. Why would most people think that things could be any different? And yet at a certain moment, revolutionary upheavals and protest movements are as if out of nowhere to challenge the logic of the system. Ideas of solidarity and collective struggle rather than individual advance take hold of millions of people. Those who say that revolution is impossible under capitalism should read the history books. Since the beginning of the 20th century, revolutions have broken out every decade, ranging from the most famous, like the Russian Revolution and the Spanish Revolution in 1936, the less well-known, like the Hungarian Revolution in 1956 and the Portuguese Revolution in 1974, that brought down a dictator who ruled for 40 years and smashed Portugal's colonial empire. Even as recently as 2019, there were mass struggles in 34 different countries in just 1 year. Any number of things can be a catalyst for revolution. It could be capitalists cutting wages. It could be war or invasion. It could be a fascist putsch. It could be an act of working class defiance, like the street vendor in Tunisia, who set himself on fire in protest at constant police harassment and thereby sparked off the Arab revolutions of 2011. Or it could simply be, like it was in France in 1968, workers decided to be left behind and wanting to grab their share of the economic growth. Each of these revolutions and revolution epochs occurs because of the inner workings of capitalism. While capitalism's defenders always uphold its seeming stability, capitalism regularly and dramatically transforms people's lives through economic booms and busts, technological transformations, industrial revolutions, wars, and as we've seen recently, pandemics. Everything is in a constant state of disturbance. Struggle between the capitalists and the working class is a necessary consequence of these changes. Such struggle is often of a fairly modest scale, a strike here, a demonstration there. But at times when the struggle starts to escalate beyond a single workplace or industry, or beyond a single partial demand, the class divisions in society start to open up. And when a class struggle is particularly intense, the long-term interests of the workers and capitalists become apparent to large numbers of people. Struggle, then, is crucial to transforming social reality and also the consciousness of the working class. Workers on strike learn that the police and the courts are set up against them and for the employers, and the press will always lie against strikers. The experience of struggle teaches solidarity to workers, calling into question divisions of race, sex, religion, sexual orientation, language, nationality that are deliberately fostered by the ruling class. Workers learn if any part of the working class is oppressed, every section of the working class is oppressed and held down. Moreover, as workers begin to organize on a wider scale, they begin to see their interests lie not in organizing one workplace or one industry for purpose of self-defense, but in organizing politically to secure better laws and beyond that to challenge the power of the state. That is why revolution must be made by the mass of the workers themselves and not by others supposedly on their behalf. When revolutions take place, it becomes obvious that workers need to take in hand all the big decisions in their organizing society. With industry grinding to a halt, the workers have to step into the breach. Who will organize the provision of food, of transport, of healthcare, of fuel and heating, of security? What to do when the bosses flee and sabotage their machinery? In such circumstances, the workers have to take over. Committees, workers' councils need to be organized on a citywide basis, linking representatives from every significant workplace and industry to work out answers to the problems confronted by the movement. These then have to appeal to workers in other citizen regions, laying open the prospect of a national uprising. This, in fact, is a pattern we've seen repeatedly over more than a century. In Russia, the workers' committees were called Soviets. In Chile, in 1973, Cordones, and in Iran, in 1979, Shoras. Whatever name they go by, they amount to the same thing, the encroachment by popular organizations of the working class over the control hitherto in the hands of the bosses. The ruling classes, of course, don't remain idle when their industries begin to fall under workers' control. They'll call the police or hire thugs to have workers removed. The question of the workers securing what they won therefore quickly comes to the fore. That means the need for self-defense, arms in hand of the workers, and down the track, the formation of workers' militias under the control of the workers' committees to repel attacks by the police and the thugs and the army. That also means appealing to the rank and file soldiers to turn their guns on their officers by appealing to them on a class basis. You too suffer because of the indignities of capitalism. You are forced to risk your lives in war from which you will gain nothing. In such circumstances, like in Russia in 1917, the army can begin to crack. Now, if they're not to be pushed into a secondary role, providing a muscle while other classes reap the rewards of revolution, workers must be organized politically to assert their independent class interests. In order for the working class to do this, those who are leading the struggle in the workplaces, on the streets, and on the campuses need to be organized into a mass revolutionary party, capable of pushing the struggle forward. Without such an organization, workers will be pushed to the sidelines, their demands ignored. You only have to compare the experience of Russia in 1917, when a quarter of a million strong Bolshevik party led the working class to power, with that of other mass uprisings in the 20th century, which were defeated to see the importance of a revolutionary party. A revolutionary party of that nature must pull together all the most militant advanced fighters. It must lead the workers and defeat those arguing to defuse the struggle and to steer into the proper channels. But As many argue, the prospect of a revolution in a country like Australia seems pretty remote. It's unsurprising that people think this. It's not just Australia's never had a revolution as compared to many other countries in the world. It's also that the whole history of class struggle is deliberately left out from most school textbooks. And yet, if you look at Australian history, class struggle and resistance to oppression is as old as Australia itself. From the Aboriginal resistance to invasion, to trade union protests against attacks on workers' rights, the country has experienced a full range of mobilisation by workers and the oppressed, short of an insurrection. And there is nothing to say we can't see such big upsurges of struggle in Australia once again. Neoliberal attacks on the working class, the environmental crisis, the threat of war in the region. The conflicts that emerge, in fact, in the future, could be much sharper and with much more extreme radicalisation. Furthermore, Australia is not isolated from the world. Revolutionary outbreaks tend to occur in waves and to spread from country to country, as capitalists all over the world try to force us to pay for their crises. It's unlikely, then, that Australia will remain immune to such outbursts of struggle elsewhere. But to make sure they are successful, a minority of the most advanced workers needs to be organised in a revolutionary party. One more thing. Revolutionaries reject the idea we can attain socialism through parliament. The strategy of reformism doesn't work. But that doesn't mean we simply fold our arms and wait for the glorious day when the workers rise up. Revolutionaries fight for every single reform in the here and now, whether that's to lift the minimum wage, to defeat anti-union laws, to improve access to abortion, to lift New Start payments, or as you see here, to free Palestine, to save the environment, to defend Muslims, to fight for marriage equality. Such a socialist alternative are always in the thick of the struggle. We do this because we want to fight for the interests and needs of the working class. We want to push back against ruling class attacks. So many things we take for granted today, from equal pay for women, to the right to demonstrate, have been won by fighting for our rights in such a fashion. But two things differentiate our approach to winning reforms from those of the reformists, the Labour Party and the Greens, for example. First, in every campaign, we want to push mass struggle to the forefront. We want to involve the largest number of people, whether that's by striking or demonstrating on the streets. We're not prepared just to sit and wait and hope that some politician will do it for us. We think that mass action, being disruptive, not just waiting for the electoral cycle to turn in our favour, is going to be much more effective at winning reforms. And second, we don't see reforms as an end in themselves. We don't see that if you just accumulate reforms one by one over the years, we'll eventually end up with a new society. We see the fight for reforms as a critical element in the fight for revolution. The means by which reforms are won is inseparable from the product of the project of transforming society. When workers win things through mass action, it builds up their confidence. The fights for reforms using revolutionary methods of struggle, particularly when they win victories and push the ruling class back, make workers much more likely to engage in future such fights and to put them in a position where, as the struggle escalates, it can be transformed into a fight for power. As the old slogan goes, we don't just want more bread, we want the whole bloody bakery. So, to draw my talk to a conclusion, it's important to note this is not just some abstract debate. It's not just that revolutionaries and reformists are all on the same side, just that revolutionaries perhaps are just a bit more boshy. That's obvious today when you look at the Albanese government, whether it's support for the fossil fuel industry or tax cuts for the rich. Revolutionaries are adamantly against Labour's agenda, and we want to organise students and workers to fight these attacks. Still more, do divisions open up when the struggle begins to heat up further. Revolutionaries and reformists will in fact be on opposite sides of the barricades, quite literally, because the reformists, while speaking sweet language about gradual reforms, will turn viciously against the working class when capitalism is threatened. Reformists are, in fact, the last line of defence for the capitalist order. Those of you who attended the talk before lunch about Germany in 1918 will know exactly what I'm talking about, when German workers followed their Russian brothers and sisters and overthrew their own imperial government. Faced with the option of leading a revolutionary challenge to capitalism, or defending the capitalist status quo, the German Social Democratic Party, 1 million strong, chose the latter. They took government with a blessing of the old state machine, which had collapsed, and proceeded to crush the workers' councils that had been spontaneously formed. They sent specially established right-wing army squads to shoot revolutionary workers. 6 months of civil war followed, in which the Social Democrats saved capitalism in Germany, killing the revolutionary leaders as they did so. So this question is not just some university debate. It has life or death consequences. Revolutions need to build our forces long before revolutionary upsurges. Otherwise, the reformists will take charge and destroy the revolution, just like we saw in Germany in 1918, just like we've seen so many other times. Socialist Alternative is committed to this project, doing our part to build a party that plays its part in the liberation of the international working class. If that sounds like the project you're prepared to devote your life to, I'd heartily encourage you to consider joining our organisations.